The following is a production of the Pritzker Military Museum and Library. Bringing citizens and citizen soldiers together through the exploration of military history, topics, and current affairs. This is Pritzker Military Presents.
Welcome to Pritzker Military Presents. I'm your host, Rob Havers. This program is a special episode with the United States Secretary of the Army, Ryan D. McCarthy. This program and hundreds more covering a full range of military topics is available on demand at PritzkerMilitary.org. I had the pleasure of traveling to the Pentagon to sit down with the Secretary of the Army to discuss diversity and inclusion in the United States Army, its history and its future. Ryan D. McCarthy was confirmed by the United States Senate on September 26, 2019, and sworn in as the 24th Secretary of the Army on September 30, 2019. As Secretary, he is the senior civilian official representing the United States Army in the Department of Defense. He is responsible for all matters relating to the U.S. Army, including the recruitment, organization, training, equipping, and care of 1.4 million active duty, National Guard, reserve soldiers, Department of the Army civilians, and their families. Secretary McCarthy proudly served in the United States Army himself from 1997 to 2002 and was involved in combat operations in Afghanistan in support of Operation Enduring Freedom with the 75th Ranger Regiment, U.S. Special Operations Command. Please enjoy this program of Pritzker Military Presents.
Mr. Secretary, very many thanks for joining me today to discuss the historical roots of diversity and inclusion in the United States Army, where the Army is going today and indeed in the future. But before we get into those questions, is there anything you would like to say or discuss first of all?
Well, one thing I say consistently and have really since Christmas of last year is this has been an extraordinary year in our in the history of the U.S. Army. On December 31st, when most Americans were getting ready to have dinner and probably celebrate the coming of a new year, U.S. Army had 178,000 troops deployed, 19 years of straight of combat operations in the Middle East, and that was normal for us. We conducted a raid and killed terrorist leader Qasem Soleimani, the Iranian Quds Force leader, which was a senior leader in the Iranian regime and came to the brink of war with the Iranian regime. And that evening, we put the orders out to put another 10,000 troops in the Middle East. They blew out and were on the ground within about 72 hours. And that was an incredibly intense time. 2 weeks later, the president's impeached from the House of Representatives, which brought about more tension here in the United States. Then another 45 days, COVID-19. And if that wasn't enough, 60 days later, social unrest after the brutal murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis, Minnesota, brought all of these extraordinary events within about a six-month period. So along with the 10,000 we had to send additional troops to the Middle East, another 45,000 troops were deployed all around the United States, where we built hospitals out of convention centers like McCormick Place in Chicago, and we augmented hospital staffs all over the country with Army doctors and nurses. We ran nursing homes in some cases in the northeastern United States. We also were distributing food and water to people all over the country who were dealing with the crisis. And when you put that all into perspective, we weren't done. The U.S. Army is central to driving the vaccine development for COVID-19, run by Army Four-Star General Gus Perna, so much so we're also not only the development of vaccines with the private sector, but we have plans in place to distribute hundreds of millions of vials to the American people. So it has been an extraordinarily busy year, and one that which has really taken its toll on the institution and the men and women that serve it.
That's a great segue, Mr. Secretary. The military, any military, and the Army in particular, is, of course, a reflection of the nation, of the society from which it is drawn and which it serves. And germane to your comments about social unrest in this country, thinking about the issue of race in the United States in the contemporary world and historically, African Americans, of course, have served with great distinction in the United States Army from the very beginning, beginning with the Revolutionary War, often as enslaved persons and later as freed men and freed women. However, their service for a substantial portion of that history was largely segregated. And it wasn't until President Harry Truman issued his executive order in July of 1948 that stipulated equal treatment and opportunity for all within the United States Armed Forces without regard for race, that some of these issues were dealt with. So what would you say, and how does the service of African-American men in the Army compare before this executive order and then post this executive order?
Well, it was a struggle before. When you have the extraordinary contributions of units like the 54th Massachusetts in 1864 during the Civil War, the Tuskegee Airmen, those are the most extraordinary examples. They performed extremely well. And even in the midst of tremendous challenges, just getting out of basic training and getting forward before they had to conduct combat operations. We just did a happy birthday message to Brigadier General McGee, who's one of the remaining survivors of the Tuskegee Airmen, 101 years young. And, you know, it's amazing because of the performance that they had to just get to that point, just what it took just to get to deploy to the European theater before they had to stare down the Nazis, extraordinary men. Unfortunately, it has taken decades to improve upon ourselves and reduce that discrimination based on race, color, or creed. You know, the declaration by President Truman took extraordinary courage, but it has taken decades for the system to improve upon itself so that men and women of color can have the opportunities to reach their maximum potential. And I think that when you look at the institution today, it's come a long way, but it still has a ways to go. The men and women that want to rise to the highest levels in this institution in the uniformed service or as civil servants, it takes decades. It takes about 25 years to produce a brigadier general. We do it all from within. So when you look at that process for an individual to come in and join our ranks, you got to get a big sample size on the front end. You got to get a lot of young men and women, the best capable people, but then it's the right assignments and the right schooling and mentoring so that they can improve upon themselves as they rise through the ranks and ultimately get a fair shake based on how well they performed that body of work that led them to that moment.
You've alluded and partially answered this question, but I'll pose it in its entirety. While not as far back as the Revolutionary War, Asian Americans, Hispanic Americans also have a long history serving the United States Army. They too faced similar levels of discrimination and segregation. During the time of segregation, many commanders did not permit segregated troops to serve in combat. Yet despite this hurdle, this barrier, there are many instances of segregated units serving with very great distinction in combat. You mentioned a couple. Any other particular units that come to mind?
Well, obviously the 442nd Regimental Combat Team in World War II, which was comprised mostly of Japanese Americans. And they were one of the most highly decorated units in the European theater. I mean, Senator Daniel Inouye was a legendary member of the United States Senate and appropriator. He was in the 442nd Regimental Combat Team and earned the Medal of Honor. And I knew a lot about that as a kid because one of my grade school teachers, a woman named Mrs. Crowley, her husband was a Captain Crowley, company commander in the 442nd. He came and spoke to us on Veterans Day, and Daniel Inouye was in his company. So when you watch that as a kid, you thought, what are they talking about? And now when I go walk down to get my laundry here in the Pentagon, I see a picture of Senator Inouye, and you read about the 442nd. So these have been challenges and struggles that have faced the nation, but they're right here within our own ranks. We've worked very hard to continue to make everything as possible that be merit-based, but there are unconscious biases within all people. Whether you're Caucasian from the north side of Chicago, or you airborne infantry, do you like people who are just in airborne infantry? Or do you like people just from Chicago? Do you like people who have similar characteristics or traits that make you feel comfortable? I mean, I don't pick everybody because they're Bears fans, even though I'm a Bears fan. But you have to work very hard to be conscious to make the right choices. Right. It's as much of the systems that we put in place as is the behaviors that we exhibit. And that's something you have to work hard on every day. When you get out of bed, you got to work on that. Because it's easy to just relax and put your guard down and do what's comfortable.
Very true. So President Truman's executive order banning segregation in the military was 16 years before the landmark Civil Rights Act of 1964. Why do you think, Mr. Secretary, that it was that the Army and the rest of the armed forces took on dealing with this injustice in such a substantial fashion, so far in advance of the rest of U.S. society?
Well, once you truly can appreciate what it takes to serve in uniform, for decades, all you'd ever hear is, "I see green. I don't see the color of the man or woman on my left and right." And that's kind of a cliche. But what people mean by that is, all we care about is, can you do the job? Will you be there when we need you the most? If you think about how tough this profession is, how dangerous it is when we have to deploy in combat operations, very quickly, you entrust the person to your left and your right with your life. And they will do the same for you. And that type of experience galvanizes individuals and overcomes any barrier. Some of the closest friends I made when I was on active duty years ago, an American Indian guy from North Carolina, an African American guy from Detroit, Michigan. I never would have met these people if I didn't join the military. It's given me tremendous perspective. But why I love these guys like brothers is because I've trusted them with my life, and they were there for me and they performed. And that's what happens with this institution. And that's what makes us special, but we still have to work hard at improving ourselves.
Moving on to gender, and similar really to the experiences of African-American males, women have also provided long-time service to the United States Army ever since the Revolutionary War era. They too, however, until another executive order by President Harry Truman, were not officially part of the ranks until 1948. So how has the integration of women in the United States Army helped improve the Army's readiness over the years?
Well, it's kind of starts with that story about my grade school teacher, Mrs. Crowley. She was a women's air service pilot. So they would fly the bombers over to position them into Europe. And her husband, Captain Crowley, was with the 442nd. So I got exposure to this when you're about 8 or 9 years old on Veterans Day every year. And you realize that over time it progressed of just how well women performed in all these roles. But it wasn't until 2015 did we have women in combat roles, in the infantry, in the armor. They're going to Ranger School. Mm-hmm. I spoke at a Ranger School graduation about two years ago, and had a female officer. She's the first female officer in the 75th Ranger Regiment, so Army Special Operations. It has taken a very long time, probably longer than it should, but I would tell you that more and more it's getting better, and we are in more and more exposure and opportunities exist. But it takes time, and it takes tremendous courage for the leaders to do the right thing and make sure everyone has the opportunity.
That answer is partially an answer to this next question, but I might ask you, Mr. Secretary, to elaborate a little bit. So for women soldiers, what did service to the Army look like before that permanent integration into the Army's ranks? And what does it look like now? And you alluded to the 75th Rangers there.
I think it's much better today than it was 25 years ago. From a personal standpoint, I deferred my orders to go on active duty to stay on to integrate the Virginia Military Institute to co-ed. But that was 25 plus years ago. West Point was 40 years ago, where women entered the first class in the Corps of Cadets. So although you're 40 years into it, it kind of gets back to the math problem that I mentioned before. If you started on active duty today, it takes you about 25 years to get promoted to the rank of Brigadier General. So as it continue, as more time marches on, more opportunity, more women are able to go in and exhibit the characteristics that the behaviors and traits that you need to be successful, more and more opportunity will present itself. We're getting better to the couple of points I made before. Women are in Army Special Operations. Women are in the space program. Women are in the general officer ranks. One of the things that will go public, their names will go public. We just had a Brigadier General board meet. We promote about 40 to 45 people a year to the rank of Brigadier General. So if every officer class, so the class of 1996 or 95, now they're about 25 years in. For the first time, we had 10 women out of 40 make it.
Wow.
Last year, we had 4 make it. Now, if you went back 4 or 5 years ago, you might not have any. It is getting better. These very talented women are getting in front of these boards, and they're getting selected. So it's very encouraging news, and it's continually diversifying our ranks of, you know, both perspective and abilities, and it's only going to make us better.
Well, and that lead time, that 25-year lead time, that's an important thing for the wider public to understand, I think.
It's important to look at the front end. You need a big enough sample size. If 13% of America is African American, you can't recruit that many people. Half of that cohort will be gone in 5 years. So in many ways, it is statistics. If the sample size keeps getting smaller as you head down, it's going to be real hard to get one person promoted, let alone 10 or 15, because you have an officer class of 5,000 people and you pick 40. It gets tough. Now, a lot's got to happen. They have to have the opportunities for the right assignments and the right schooling and the right, because assignment's a big part of it. You have to get the right jobs to understand how to run this enterprise. It wouldn't be any different than running a large corporation. Do you understand operations? Do you understand finance? Do you understand the customer? How do you run the corporation if you don't understand the basic fundamentals of the business? Same thing holds true here. If you have the ability, we got to make sure you have the right experiences so you can become General James McConville, the Chief Staff of the Army.
Moving on, so from 48, the Army is no longer segregated by race. Women are permitted to serve in active duty roles, yet there is another group still not permitted to serve altogether. Individuals who today would identify as members of the LGBTQ community. What would have happened if a soldier had either self-identified or was discovered to be gay back then?
At that time, yes. I mean, they were in cases were forced out of the service. In 1993, they created the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy. And then obviously that was lifted during the first term of the Obama administration. I think it was at the end of 2010, early 2011. They lifted that policy and then obviously could openly serve. So it had, again, another thing that had taken time. But it was in many ways the U.S. military pushing this forward to help support the LGBTQ movement. And thing that's ironic is that even at times when men and women were in uniform in the 90s, they would often know, but it wasn't important to them. It didn't matter because this individual was an outstanding SAW gunner and it didn't matter. They could perform. Time would march on, and ultimately were not placed in this awkward position where they had to hide something from their teammates. And that's a trust issue. And nothing is more important than trust in this profession. So it's great to have everything out there in the open and allow people to live their lives the way they choose to.
So that's another good segue into the march of progress, if you like, Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and then the repeal of that, and then LGBTQ individuals permitted to serve openly in the United States Army. In what ways does that change the Army itself?
Well, I think it allows individuals to live their lives with more confidence. It allows them to have more trust with their teammates, so they don't have to hide something. They don't have to, you know, feel like they should be embarrassed about something. This is the great thing about this country. Don't break the laws, but live your life how you choose to live it. So I think that is only improved us and strengthened the bond between our men and women.
So while there's obviously been a great deal of progress in the United States Army, recent events, contemporary events, and you alluded to them, Mr. Secretary, at the beginning of our discussion, have prompted the wider public to look more closely, more intentionally, perhaps for the first time for some, to look at issues of race, racism, sexism, other prejudices within our society. Diversity, inclusion has become very much more important in many ways to many more people in this country, I think. The military, of course, is central to this understanding and is grappling with these issues, as are many other elements of society. Recently, you and General McConville, Chief of Staff of the Army, announced a new initiative, Project Inclusion. What's the object of this project, and what initial successes have you seen thus far?
So we wanted to make the discussion of race part of a daily, your daily rhythm in the course of it, whether it's a training day or a deployment, that you talk about this and have an appreciation and understanding for your teammates. One of the things that he and I and Sergeant Major Jeremy Grinson do whenever we go anywhere, where are you from? And at the beginning, I'm Ryan McCarthy. I grew up in Chicago, and I tell them about myself. Because what our concern was is we were becoming an army of strangers. You're incredibly busy. You work real hard to do your job, and then you race home to be with your family, and your teammates don't really know you that well. Do you have problems with your marriage? Do you have financial problems? Are you depressed? If you don't understand these things, you're not going to know, you're not going to see it coming when a teammate has a suicidal ideation. If they're going to have problems at home, have a domestic violence issue. This is where teammates understanding each other are going to be there when they need them, whether that's at home or deployments, out in training. So inclusion is more of just bring the entire team together and try to understand each other and all the aspects of that individual, where they're from and within their personal life. So our purpose behind this is to be better teammates and to ensure that everybody has the opportunity to reach their maximum potential.
Yesterday, I had a brief opportunity to take a quick look around the brand new and very impressive National Museum of the United States Army, a wonderful institution. The sort of introductory film there talks about the seven core values of the United States Army. So how does diversity, inclusion align with these core Army values, would you say?
We treat everyone with dignity and respect. And being selfless, you're taking care of your teammates. And treating with people with dignity and respect is inclusion. We come from every corner of the country, every walk of life. Socioeconomics, all of it is flattened. The moment you raise your right hand and you take that oath, and you get a haircut and you show up at your initial entry training, whether that's enlisted or as an officer. So for us, to truly understand each other, we have to treat each other equally. So that it strikes to the heart of our values and who we are as an institution, because we take care of each other, we take care of their families, we take care of our countrymen, fellow countrymen.
You said at the beginning, Mr. Secretary, that any army is a reflection of the nation, the society that it serves and from which it is drawn. Listening to your answers just now, and thinking about what it is you said, it seems to me, and probably to our audience, that the United States Army is actually both catalyst for change as well as reflection of change in that society that it serves. Could you comment on that a little bit?
Absolutely. We have led the way throughout our history. How ironic is that? We're the ones that fought for America. We're the oldest institution in America. We're 1 year older, 1 year older than the country. We're 245 years old. And it should be fitting. We are a people organization. And we come from every corner of the country. So at times, as much as there are challenges in our city streets, there are challenges in our ranks. When you bring in 70,000 new people every summer, the team changes every summer. And you have to adjust. For as much as they have to adjust to our lifestyle, which is very different, we have to adjust to them. We have to get to know them, and we have to win them over so we can keep them on the team. It's only fitting that we do that. And we have done a very, you know, at times we had our challenges, and you have growing pains with all kinds of change. But we're very proud of our history, and we try to improve upon it every day.
Is there anything else you'd like to say, Mr. Secretary?
You know, these are tough times. Like I mentioned before, all of the instances that I described happened in about a six-month horizon from the 178,000 deployed combat operations, go to the brink of war with Iran, impeachment, COVID, social unrest. That's about 80 years of experiences in 6 months. It brings tremendous tension on the country. It brings tremendous tension on our men and women in uniform, our civil servants that are in our ranks. But we're not without our faults and challenges. But the leadership of the Army is really pushing hard on these issues. And we know we're going to improve upon it. And the final point is how proud we are of General Gus Purnam, who leads Operation Warp Speed. He was on 60 Minutes last weekend with his deputy, General Paul Ostrowski. Army leaders working with industry. There's about 5 vaccine candidates that are going to be available to the American public right around, starting in the January timeframe through the spring. And just encouraging all Americans to trust us, to take the vaccine, so that we can create as much herd immunity as we can as a country and turn the corner on COVID-19.
Secretary of the Army Ryan McCarthy, thank you very much for your time today.
I want to thank Secretary McCarthy for a great discussion about important topics affecting the United States Army. To learn more about the Pritzker Military Museum and Library, visit us in person or online at pritzkermilitary.org. Thank you, and please join us next time on Pritzker Military Presents.
Be a part of our live studio audience, explore military history, and learn more about our series by visiting PritzkerMilitary.org.
Pritzker Military Presents is made possible by members of the Pritzker Military Museum and Library and its sponsors. The views and opinions expressed in this program are not necessarily those of the museum and library. The preceding program was produced by the Pritzker Military Museum and Library.